Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by contributors from community radio stations across Canada. This episode of Groundwire was produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Akin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nihiyawak and the Nakota. I am your host, Susan Hubert. On today's show,
they're shutting down the most marginalized artists.
Math has become such a blight on not only this city, but this province.
Nicholas Gibbs' lives mattered, Black lives mattered, and we are here for you, and we will be here for you as long as your struggle continues.
But first, here are the headlines. Our first headline comes from CKUW in so-called Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe Akin, the homeland of the Métis and the historical territory of the Nihiyawak and the Nakota.
Members of Amalgamated Transit Union Local 1505, which represents the 1,460 bus drivers and other employees within Winnipeg's municipal transit system, may end up halting work if the terms presented by them to the city on Friday, August 16th are not agreed to. The proposal was in response to the city's offer, which was overwhelmingly rejected by union members on that same Friday. The main sticking point for transit workers is less the need for increased wages than the need for better scheduling to accommodate both drivers and riders. In an interview with CKUW's Emily Leadham for the program Rank and File Radio, Prairie Edition, ATU 1505 President Aleem Chowdhury explained that the current schedules are so tight they leave no room for drivers to go to the bathroom or take a breather.
You're fighting traffic, you're fighting the people, you're fighting everything that's, you know, it's crazy. So you could be running up to half hour late at a time, and that's quite stressful. It's a natural reaction for a human being when they're running late. I don't know if you ever notice even yourself that if you're running late, you speed up a bit. And that causes a hazard because now you're speeding a bit and there's a lot more chance of you getting into an accident.
As of Monday, August 19th, the city was still reviewing the union's counterproposal, which demanded less in terms of wage increases than the city was offering, with more emphasis on improving drivers' working conditions. For more of the background, look up the June 30th edition of Rank and File Radio, Prairie Edition, on SoundCloud.
A new study by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives reports that in nearly every Canadian neighbourhood studied, the hourly wage needed to rent an apartment is far above minimum wage and rising quickly. Catherine Fisher of CJLY on Sinaik's traditional territory in BC brings us the details in the following report.
A new study by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives reports that in nearly every neighbourhood studied, the hourly wage needed to rent an apartment is far above the minimum wage and rising quickly. The report, which is called Unaccommodating, maps rental affordability in neighbourhoods across Canada by calculating the rental wage, the hourly wage needed to afford an average apartment without spending more than 30% of one's earnings. Some findings of the report. One in four Canadians earns within $3 of their province's minimum wage. The national average wage needed to afford a two-bedroom apartment in Canada is $22.40 an hour, or $20.20 an hour for an average one-bedroom. Only 3% of the 795 neighborhoods studied allow for a full-time minimum wage worker to rent an average two-bedroom apartment without spending more than 30% of their income, and in only 9% of neighborhoods can they afford a one-bedroom. There are no neighborhoods in the Greater Toronto Area or Metro Vancouver where a full-time minimum wage worker could afford an apartment without paying much more than 30% of their earnings. You can download the report and look at the companion map on the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives website at www.policyalternatives.ca/unaccommodate.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back.
Gotta go, I'm coming with you. We'll cross the new divide. You are my mystery, future and history. I'm always on your side. I'm always on your side.
You are listening to Groundwire Community Radio News, available online at www.groundwirenews.ca. You just heard Leaf Rapids with a title track from their 2019 album, Citizen Alien. Now it's time for our feature stories. Chip Wilson is best known as the founder of athletic wear corporation Lululemon, but his property development firm Low Tide Properties now finds itself at the center of Vancouver's housing affordability crisis. Activists gathered outside the billionaire's $73 million Point Grey mansion last week to protest Low Tide Properties purchasing and shutting down over 18 artist spaces over the last 2 years. The following feature was produced by Jesse Wensloff with contributions from Caitlin Vanderhave. From CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC, on the traditional unceded ancestral lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples.
I'm Tasha. I was one of the organizers for the rave against rent evictions, which was a protest rave outside of Chip Wilson's $73 million mansion. I'm involved with the Vancouver Tenants Union, but also I'm a member of the electronic music community here.
What inspired you to rave against rent evictions?
The Bassiani protest rave that happened last year in Georgia. So ever since that happened, I was really inspired to see how can we create something similar here. Dance music in general. If you look at how electronic music started, these were very political movements, creating a community that was against the status quo. That's what really inspired me, because that's truly, I think, what dance music, electronic music is about. Is it's very radical and political and queer. When I found out that we were losing Index, which was quite an important venue for the community, and that it was Low Tide Properties owned by Chip Wilson, that's what spurred my research into Chip Wilson and seeing how many other venues and spaces he's shut down, including the old Red Gate Society, which was a big loss to the community last year as well. This was already when we have such a lack of venues here in Vancouver. I knew that we had to do something about it.
Labor activist and member of the Vancouver Tenants Union, Rocco Trigueros, spoke at the protest.
How immoral do you consider yourself an example of success when you evict people, tenants, artists, and fill these spaces like Index, Merch, Red Gate Art Society, Artist Collective, small businesses? You're just like a machine destroying everything.
They're responsible for shutting down over 18 spaces in the last 2 years. They're also responsible for taking away the New Forms Festival venue. And this was land that was supposed to be held in a trust with Emily Carr and UBC, and they decided to sell that property to Low Tide. And now their new mandate is apparently not including culture. It's absolutely ridiculous. They're shutting down the most marginalized artists, and this is the underground, and we know that this is where innovation and creativity happens.
How did we get here? What are the roots of this affordability crisis? Vancouver City Councillor Jean Swanson.
One of the things that's happened in the downtown east side is the city passed a community plan, and that community plan said that you can have really high buildings and you can change everything to gentrify it. As a result, the property values are increasing, the taxes are increasing, and rents are increasing because, of course, there's no rent control.
Tasha says artists and nonprofit organizations are further disadvantaged by the terms of standard commercial leases.
These triple net leases, which are the standard of commercial buildings here, it means that commercial tenants are responsible not just for the rent, but also for property taxes, for the maintenance fees. So really, these developers are buying these buildings at no loss to themselves. And it's like Starbucks can afford that, a bank can afford that. But when that's the same for an artist or a collective or a nonprofit or a charity, you know, it's not a level playing field whatsoever.
So how can this issue be resolved? Councillor Jean Swanson says the city does have some existing plans to help artists find space.
The city has a target of supporting 30 more artist spaces, and so that there's no net loss of artist space.
and also wants to build 400 social housing units for artists in the next 10 years. And the city is also working to get a new tax class that could take the tax pressure off of non-profit spaces in commercial areas.
What more could the city be doing? There are some common sense solutions.
Let's work for a graduated property tax system that gives small businesses and artists a break while raising funds from big businesses like Low Tide and Amazon that can really afford to pay. And then we can use some of that graduated property tax to pay for artists' community spaces and truly affordable housing. In the meantime, Chip Wilson, stop profiting off the community's lost art and stop gentrifying vulnerable communities. You're a billionaire. You have other choices for ways of making money.
Protesters' message for Wilson was met with a flippant dismissal of their art as worthless, highlighting a fundamental disagreement about the role and value of art in community building. From CJSF 90.1 FM on the unceded ancestral territories of the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples, I'm Jesse Wenslaw.
On Monday, August 12th, Premier Brian Pallister officially dropped the writ, kicking off a provincial election which would see Manitobans go to the polls on September 10th. CKUW's Michael Welch connected with some of the nonpartisan groups and individuals trying to showcase the issues and policies they believe need to be addressed by the leaders in the lead-up to the election day.
Lisa Forbes is an organizer with Winnipeg Indigenous Rock the Vote, a grassroots voter educational organization aiding community members in their efforts to choose governments that will address their concerns. While noting that many Indigenous community members correctly see Canadian governments as part of a colonial system that has historically excluded and disenfranchised them, Forbes argues the need to mobilize at the polls to shape the legislatures and parliaments whose policies are impacting Indigenous peoples in the here and now.
Sure, we'd like a better system, but for right now, today, we need to save lives of kids in care. We need to reduce the number of Indigenous people incarcerated. We need better education systems so that we have enough subsidies for people to go to school. We need good workplace training stuff. We need lots of different kinds of things that affect us right now, and I think we can do both things.
Eric Redder is the Winnipeg-based Wilderness and Water Campaigner for the Wilderness Committee, a registered charity and watchdog organization focused on the health of wild species and wild spaces. Redder sees climate change and its impacts as the number one concern facing Manitobans and suggests the October 2018 report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change as a barometer for the commitment and seriousness of would-be governments' leadership on the environment.
So the first question is, have they read that report, and what does that mean for Manitoba? You get a lot of humming and hawing and trying to figure out ways that they can maybe mitigate reaching that goal or shy away from reaching that goal. Then you understand that this person is not the leader that society needs right now.
Redder acknowledges as well that one cannot talk about the health of Lake Winnipeg without reviewing watersheds throughout the province, as they are connected.
Every single creek, every single drainage ditch, every single place that you see water flowing, whether it's in spring when the water is running heavy or if it's in the middle of summer and there's still water in it, every single one of those areas needs to be cared for. The sheer scope of that is immense, and that's an essential for us to maintain water.
For Redder, increased mining activity within Manitoba parks is a serious concern that political leaders need to address.
When we polled people last year, 70% of Manitobans across the board, it was urban and rural, it was men and women, 70% of Manitobans said, yeah, we have to stop industrial activity in parks. And a 70% is as high a number as you're going to see these days. And that's something that the government, any elected official should take to heart and start making the plan for.
The Wilderness Committee sent a questionnaire to all political candidates to survey their plans on caring for Manitoba's environment. Responses to the questions will be available September 3rd, a week before Election Day, at the site www.wildernesscommittee.org/Manitoba Election Survey 2019. Todd Donahue is a Winnipeg resident with 10 years of experience as a social justice advocate for the most marginalized populations in the city's West Broadway neighborhood. He recently started the Meth Crisis Action Group on Facebook to raise the profile of the worsening methamphetamine situation in the hopes of influencing the discourse around the drug and moving forward concrete action plans to address the epidemic. As someone who has worked with many addicted community members in the last 4 years, he has not been satisfied with the approaches fielded by the major candidates to date.
None of them speak to the meth crisis in particular. It's lumped into their poverty strategies or their homelessness strategies, or they're all lumped in together. Meth has become such a blight on not only this city, but this province. It's a national crisis.
Donahue notes that addressing the circumstances of meth addiction requires a financial commitment.
There's minimal street outreach. There's not enough safe housing for them. There's not enough transitional housing for them. They would benefit from something like safe consumption sites. Again, it's a funding issue.
Manitobans go to the polls September 10th. Voters interested in attending upcoming leaders and all candidates' debates or other campaign-related events can find details at the site manitobaelection.ca. From Winnipeg on Occupied Anishinaabe Gakin, the homeland of the Métis Nation, the historical territory of the Nahiowak and the Nakota, this is CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
Our final feature comes from CKUT 90.3 FM, broadcasting on so-called Montreal, the traditional and unceded territory of the Gnegahaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. On Saturday, August 17th, community members gathered on Place des Arts to commemorate the first anniversary of the killing of Nicholas Gibbs, a 23-year-old father of three, by the SPVM. This took place following the recent decision of Quebec's Superior Court to permit a class action lawsuit by the Black Coalition of Quebec against the City of Montreal for victims of racial profiling.
For me, it's very shocking, and I still can't believe today that Nicholas is dead. And so near to my house, I have forgiven the police, but I will still go on to seek justice. They need to go to prison. It's about time they get charged. They need a different mindset. They need to work with the public. They need to know how to speak to people, people in crisis, especially people with mental illness. They don't deserve to die. My son was not prepared to die, and they murdered him. They're doing a different mindset. They can't come into the force with anger and frustration. They have to know there are people out there in crisis who need help, how to speak to them, how to calm them down, and not to be trigger crazy. What is the government going to do? What the ministers is going to do? They don't want body camera because they know that they will get caught. The government do the dirty work. The judges, everyone, they need to review. They need to check what this policeman is doing. Enough is enough. I will not forget what they do to my son.
It's been 1 year since the police killing of Nicholas Gibbs, who was a father and a son and a community member to so many. It's been 30 years, more than 30 years, since the police killing of Anthony Griffin in NDG, another young Black person who was senselessly killed by the police. It's been just over a decade since Freddy Villanueva was killed, a Latino teenager, for playing dice in the park. This ongoing senseless destruction of life is a pattern in this city and this province and in this country, one that is important that we interrupt today. We're here, of course, in solidarity with the family of Nicholas Gibbs, not only to remember, but to say that this never should have happened and that we should never let this happen again. I think it's important that we think about the long history for a moment of this kinds of senseless death. If we look to the origins of law enforcement, of policing, of incarceration in this country, I think if we look to the fact that the first prison was opened in 1834, the year that slavery was abolished in what is now Canada, we see that there's a long history of the control over Black communities that dates back not only decades when we've seen these high-profile killings, but centuries. If we look back to the way that enslaved Black people who ran away were not only surveilled in public space, but often killed and brutalized as punishment for trying to seek freedom, we realize that Black people's lives have been senselessly taken for centuries.
I'm also thinking about the ongoing disproportionate punishment of black people. For example, a black woman named Lydia in Nova Scotia who was publicly whipped as punishment for stealing condiments. We see that black people continue to be punished for existing, for being present. Nicholas Gibbs should be alive right now. We need to see that certain kinds of racialized punishment in our society were never interrupted when the institution called slavery was abolished. But to paraphrase Angela Davis, it was only rebuilt into new institutions that continue to control black people's lives and curtail our ability to be free. It is endemic, and it's living on in the Montreal police, very clearly. The children of Nicholas Gibbs deserve to have a father, and we deserve to live in a city and a province and a continent in which black people's lives are not subjected to beatings, to random stops, to tasers, and to the senseless end of life that we continue to see. We've seen so much. We've been offered many scraps as communities that have been intervening across these years. We've been given the so-called Bureau d'Enquête Indépendante, which is actually staffed by largely ex-police staff. We see that after 77 cases, there have only been 2 charges. We know that police impunity is ongoing. But we are also here to say that that time is over, that the end to the police destruction of black people's lives is over, that we are here to end the police killings of black communities more broadly. Nicholas Gibbs' lives mattered, black lives mattered, and we are here for you, and we will be here for you as long as your struggle continues.
We demand that health resources must address the issues of anti-black racism, systemic racism, queerphobia, transphobia, and be safe, useful, physically and financially accessible to all people, all black people. The police cannot be the first responders in case of distress or mental health crises. We demand that the name or names of the officers involved in the death of Nicholas Gibbs and all of the other victims be made public. It's a year later, we don't know who the killer cops were. So excuse us if we blame all the cops who stand in silent solidarity with killer cops. We want data on police intervention on black people. We want the data to be collected and made public. There was a study that the SPVM did. There's the City of Montreal commissioned and executed a study on racial profiling that was completed 2 years ago and never released. They hid it. We only know about it because of a Freedom of Information request that we had to fight for. What do they have to hide? Why do we have to fight to know what our police are doing? Racial identity cannot be a death sentence in times of crisis. The SPVM and the City of Montreal must be held responsible. The SPVM has once again proven that they are incapable of finding nonviolent ways to defuse moments of crisis, especially when it comes to members of Indigenous and Black communities. It's not acceptable. Black lives matter.
Black lives matter.
Black lives matter.
Black lives matter.
You are still listening to Groundwire, community news broadcasting from coast to coast to coast and available online at www.groundwirenews.ca. Now it's time for our community radio report. CKUW's Michael Welch brings us the following report on the funding for a grant to CKUT for growing Indigenous participation and content at the station.
According to a July release from the Community Radio Fund of Canada, 40 grassroots initiatives have received funding from the national organization through its Radio Meters program. The release states that these initiatives, centered around campus and community radio stations across the country, is intended to enhance the broadcast of local news and community programming, promote local and emerging artists, encourage new broadcasting technologies, and ensure the viability and ability of those stations to serve their communities. One of the projects receiving a grant is McGill University-based CKUT 90.3 FM. The broadcaster is receiving $49,000 for growing Indigenous participation and content. Kai Riella co-authored the grant application alongside news director Gal Mahadevan. Groundwire recently reached out to Kai to get more details on the project and how the financing would achieve the station's goals.
I pitched this idea to grow Indigenous content. So the first p- portion of that would be to hire a coordinator who would be in charge of doing outreach to recruit Indigenous volunteers, both in a general volunteer sort of capacity, but also to program several new Indigenous shows. So the deliverables for that are that we are creating one extra Indigenous news program, one Indigenous music program on our grid, and then several Indigenous arts and culture programs.
Okay.
And also part of this project was a separate project with the music department and working with our archivists and music librarians to, in air quotes, decolonize the music library. We thought that it would be an idea to physically separate the Indigenous music. One of the things that we see is that CBC has created CBC Indigenous, which tries to speak to various perspectives on Indigenous issues within Canada. And I think CKUT, we've always tried to offer perspectives that are outside of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation and not influenced by perhaps federal or state politics, so very grassroots. And we also understand that the current staff at CKUT aren't perhaps well equipped to do it, and that's why we're sort of trying to allow it to be a project of self-representation where an Indigenous hire can work with Indigenous people to create Indigenous programming, to self-represent Indigenous nations and communities, and not have us decide what is being represented and what's not being represented.
It sounds as if there's a larger aim at decolonization, but the scope of this grant application is somewhat limited.
Yeah, and I would hope that that would exist within other sectors and in other parts of society, that actual decolonization or actual reconciliation was being done truthfully and not just as sort of a measure to check boxes. For us, like right now, what it means is that it's clearing up spaces on our grid to make room for Indigenous content. So we are giving up space that, you know, rightfully belongs to the perspectives and the narratives and the lives of the, you know, original caretakers and custodians and stewards of these lands that, you know, Canada sits on. So my intention would be for this to further grow. And, you know, when we talk about nation-to-nation relationships, for it to reflect the type of society that we actually want to be living in.
Thank you to Gao Mahadevan of CKUT for her assistance in producing that feature. For Groundwire, this has been CKUW's Michael Welch.
That was our community radio report. That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on an occupied Anishinaabe Akin, the homeland of the Métis and the historical territory of the Nahiawak and the Nakota. Headlines this week were written by Catherine Fisher and Michael Welch. We also thank Emily Leadham, Jesse Wensloff, and Caitlin Vanderhave for their contributions. Music this week was from Leaf Rapids. I've been your host, Susan Hubert. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at www.groundwirenews.ca. Thanks for tuning in.